The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the authors and participants, and do not necessarily represent those of iHeartMedia, Stuff Media, or its employees. Listener discretion is advised. From iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV, Monster presents Insomniac.
I'm Scott Benjamin, and everything I'm about to tell you is real. This is Insomniac. Beginning in 1970, and all the way through August of 1973, there was a pattern forming in the community of Houston Heights, in the northwest central area of Houston, Texas. Young boys, lots of them, were disappearing. More than 40 in all, before it finally ended. Parents were frantic, reporting the missing children to the Houston police. But the police were quick to dismiss the cases, all of them, as runaways. It was a decision that they would later regret, as community backlash was intense when the real nature of the disappearances was soon uncovered. Occasionally, the parents would receive a note from their missing sons, written in their own handwriting, stating that they had moved away to find work, or they were going to stay with a friend for a while. Some even received telephone calls from their missing sons, stating the same. Of course, none of that was true. The boys were forced to write those notes or to make those calls to their parents. Now that the circle of trust included Elmer Wayne Henley, Dean Corll raised the stakes in his deadly game. He offered both of his young companions, Brooks and Henley, $200 for each boy they could lure into his house as a victim. Henley later claimed that he ignored Corll's offer until early 1972, when his family was in need of the money. The truth is, we'll never really know the first time Henley claimed his $200 bounty for the life of a friend. But we do know that it became a regular occurrence. Here's the way it worked. Henley and Corll came up with a plan that, coincidentally, was almost identical to what John Wayne Gacy was doing in Chicago at the very same time. They thought of a way to get a teen to willingly wear a pair of handcuffs. It was almost like a game to them. Henley would first wear the cuffs himself, behind his back, and he would somehow escape, making it look easy. The secret was, he had a key hidden in his back pocket. The teenage victim would attempt the same, but when the cuffs didn't release, Dean would pounce on the victim, quickly binding and gagging them so that no one could hear them scream. Henley claimed that's when he would leave the victim alone with Corll, believing that he was to be delivered to the Dallas-based sex slavery ring. Again, there was never any evidence of Dean Corll belonging to such a group. Maybe the most chilling part of all this, at least so far, is that the teens and younger kids in the neighborhood that Brooks and Henley were delivering to Dean Corll for just $200 each were their neighbors and childhood friends. The same kids they grew up with and the same kids they went to school with. The date was August 7th, 1973, and Henley, now age 17, had invited a friend, Timothy Curley, age 19, to a party at Dean's house. When Henley and Curley made it to Dean's house that evening, they drank alcohol and sniffed paint fumes before leaving around midnight to buy some sandwiches. David Brooks was not at Dean's house that evening. Along the way, the two teens stopped near Henley's house, and Henley walked to the home of Rhonda Williams, age 15. She was a friend of Henley's, and her drunk father had beaten her early in the evening. She said she wanted to get out of the house until he was sober. Henley, invited her to join them at Dean Quarles' home that evening. And the three teens drove to Dean's house in Pasadena. It was about 3 a.m. on August 8, 1973, when the three arrived at Dean's house. Dean was extremely angry with Henley for inviting a girl to his house, telling him that he had ruined everything. Henley explained the situation to Coral, and he seemed to calm down as he offered the three of them more alcohol and marijuana as they continued to sniff paint fumes. Dean sat back and watched. After 2 hours, all of the teens had passed out. When Henley finally awoke, he was lying on his stomach, and Dean Coral was placing handcuffs on his wrists. He already had his mouth taped shut, and his ankles were bound together. Both Timothy Curley and Rhonda Williams were lying beside Henley on the floor. Similar to his situation, they were both gagged with tape and bound with nylon rope. Timothy Curley was already completely naked, while Rhonda Williams still had her clothes on. When Dean noticed that Henley was awake, he removed his gag just long enough to tell him that he had made a fatal mistake in bringing a girl to the house. He was going to kill all three of them after he tortured Curley. Dean then shoved a .22 caliber pistol into Henley's stomach and threatened to shoot him. Henley was able to calm Coral by telling him that he would assist him in the torture and murder of the other two teens, but he would have to release him from his restraints. Surprisingly, Dean agreed to this and untied Henley, and then tied Curley and Williams to opposite sides of his torture board. Dean's plan was for Henley to rape and kill Williams, while he raped and killed Curley. By now, the other two teens had awakened, and the reality of the situation was sinking in. Both were terrified, and Williams, whose gag was now also removed, asked Henley, "Is this for real?" Henley told her it was, and then asked Dean if he could take Williams into the other room. Coral was busy violating Curley and ignored Henley's request. It was at this point that Henley made a grab for Dean's pistol and began shouting at Dean that he had gone far enough. He couldn't go on any longer. He couldn't have Dean killing all of his friends. Dean shouted back defiantly and taunted Henley by yelling, "Kill me, Wayne." And then as he moved closer to Henley, he yelled, "You won't do it." That's when Henley fired the first shot, hitting Dean Coral in the forehead. But the bullet didn't go through his skull. As Dean moved even closer, Henley fired another two rounds into Coral's left shoulder. This stopped him, and Dean staggered out of the room as Henley fired three more rounds into his lower back and shoulder. Dean was dead. Henley had killed Dean Coral and saved the lives of two of his friends, as well as his own. Curley and Williams were released from the torture board by Henley, and the three of them dressed and talked about what they should do next. Henley just wanted to leave, but Curley said no, they should call the police. They all agreed, and Henley made the call. Aside from the Corvette that Dean Coral had purchased for David Owen Brooks, which Dean still had limited access to, he owned another flashy car, a Plymouth GTX. It wasn't a coincidence that he drove a car like this. It was fast and loud, and it seemed to attract the attention of all the teenage boys in the neighborhood. Exactly what Dean wanted. Coral, along with Brooks and Henley, would cruise the neighborhood looking for potential victims, and then lure the boys either into the car or to Coral's home with a promise of candy or alcohol, or even a party. But the GTX wasn't Dean's only car. He owned another vehicle that served a more useful purpose, a Ford Econoline van. This is the universal, sketchy van that your parents warned you to stay away from. Prior to his killing years, Coral would occasionally invite the neighborhood kids that lived near the candy store to picnic with him at the beach, using the van for transportation, of course. According to those that had accepted a ride years earlier, it was much nicer at the time, carpeted and clean. However, by the time the authorities seized the van, immediately after Dean's death, it was just as creepy and awful inside as you might guess. By then, it was in regular use to haul dead bodies from Dean's house to one of several burial places. It was even rumored that he used this as a mobile torture van, similar to the torture room he had set up in the bedroom of his house, complete with pegboard-like walls, featuring drilled holes that served the same purpose as his torture board did in his home. The van's rear windows were completely covered by thick blue curtains, impossible to see in and impossible to see out. The cargo area of the van was no longer neatly carpeted, but instead held a worn-out section of a beige rug that was covered in stains. Police also found a length of rope and a hand-built wooden crate with air holes drilled in the sides. Around the same time, police found a similar wooden crate in Dean Coral's backyard. But inside that one, they also found strands of human hair, leaving little doubt that Dean used these crates to secure and transport some of his victims. The sad truth is, all of the young boys that were seen getting into the van or car along with Dean and his two accomplices between the years of 1970 and 1973, well, they never came back. Initially, Henley was treated as a hero, saving the lives of two of his friends from a real-life monster. But Henley soon began to tell the authorities a lot more than they ever bargained for. He told them how he and David Brooks were in charge of finding teenage boys for Dean Coral's rape, torture, and murder fantasies. He also told them he himself had assisted in several abductions and murders and helped to torture and mutilate 6 or 8 victims before they were killed. He told them about the Southwest Houston boat storage shed that Dean Coral had rented, where most of the victims had been buried, while others were buried at High Island Beach and Lake Sam Rayburn. Police didn't want to believe his stories initially. That is, until he mentioned a few specific names of the boys he had helped to abduct for Dean. All of the names he provided were listed as missing children. Later, that very same day, August 8th, 1973, Henley agreed to go to the Southwest Houston boat storage shed with the authorities. He claimed he could lead them to the bodies of the missing children. When they opened the door to the enclosed boat shed, there was some assorted junk to be moved. A half-stripped, stolen car, a kid's bicycle, 2 sacks of lime, and boxes full of teenage boys' clothing. When it came time to dig, the work was done by prison trustees, and the soft dirt inside the boat shed was relatively easy to move. Almost right away, they uncovered the body of a young teenage boy, wrapped in clear plastic and buried beneath a layer of lime. As they continued to dig, they found several more sets of human remains, each in different stages of decomposition. Most of the bodies were wrapped in the same thick, clear plastic sheeting. Some had been strangled, and the ropes were still wrapped around their neck, while others had been shot. Digging up decaying bodies in an enclosed metal shed is hard enough to imagine. But when you also consider this was Texas, in August, the heat and the smell must have been unbearable. On that first day, the bodies of 8 young boys were pulled from the ground in the boat shed. All of them had been sodomized, and all of them showed evidence of sexual torture, including chewed genitals, objects inserted into their rectums, pubic hairs plucked out, and one other particularly sadistic treatment. Authorities learned through examining the bodies that Dean Coral had inserted glass rods into the boys' penises, and then he would snap them off and shatter them while they were inside. The pain this inflicted would make a person beg to be put out of their misery. But Coral would keep the teens alive for several days of this type of abuse. While conducting my research for the Dean Coral story, I kept returning to the one fact I simply couldn't wrap my mind around for the longest time. And to be honest with you, I still can't completely understand it. My question was this: why weren't the Houston police more concerned about the pattern of missing teens? Over a relatively short span of time, around 2.5 years, there were approximately 40 teens missing from the same neighborhood. Two families had lost not just one son, but 2 kids each, teen brothers, all taken at separate times. What had to happen for the authorities to finally take action? What was the hesitation? Well, I think I found the answer, or at least the best explanation I've heard so far. It comes from a book written in 1974 by a man named Jack Olson, titled The Man with the Candy, The Story of the Houston Mass Murders. In it, Olson states that it was not just one factor, but rather a combination of factors that led to the oversight. First, the Houston Police Department simply lacked the resources to search for missing children, so requests to do so were often declined. It's also true that teens occasionally choose to leave home in pursuit of something new, different, and exciting, a perceived new life, just somewhere else. It was easy for the police to tell the parents that their missing teen was merely a runaway. Easy, because that's what they truly believed had happened. It's also important to remember that the term serial killer wasn't even coined until 1974. Before that, it was almost unimaginable that a killer of this sort was living in the same neighborhood, along with the families of the kids he was killing. Unimaginable, that is, until Henley shot and killed Dean Coral in the early morning hours of August 8th, 1973, and the truth was then known. Any way you look at it, this was an especially dark time for the community of Houston Heights. The senseless destruction of dozens of young men, all with the rest of their lives ahead of them, as they were taken far too young. Dean Coral's oldest victim was 20 years old. His youngest was only 9. David Brooks turned himself in at the Houston police station. He was accompanied by his father, as he denied being involved in the murders, but stated that he did know that Coral had raped and killed 2 boys in 1970. The next day, August 9th, 1973, Henley accompanied the authorities to Lake Sam Rayburn, where 2 additional bodies were found in shallow, lime-covered graves. At the same time, police continued to search the boat shed, and they discovered an additional 9 bodies on their second day of digging. Henley insisted there were still two more bodies inside, but they were never located. Later that evening, David Brooks finally gave a full confession, admitting to being present while some of the killings occurred and helping to bury some of the bodies. The next day, August 10th, Henley accompanied the authorities to Lake Sam Rayburn, where they were able to find two more bodies. That same afternoon, both Henley and Brooks went with the authorities to High Island Beach and led the police to two more shallow graves. Days later, on August 13th, Henley and Brooks returned to High Island Beach with the police, where they located four more bodies. Again, Henley insisted that there were still two additional bodies to be found on the beach, but they were never located. In total, they had uncovered 27 known victims, with the possibility of at least four more, according to Henley. At the time, it was the worst killing spree in American history. A grisly record that would only stand for five more years until John Wayne Gacy was captured in 1978 after killing 33 young men and boys and burying them in his crawl space. In the end, Dean Corll was the only one who escaped without suffering the consequences. Maybe he paid the ultimate price, losing his life, but it was his young accomplices that eventually had to answer for all of his wrongdoings, along with their own, of course, and they're still paying for it today. In 1975, David Owen Brooks was found guilty of abduction and murder and received a life sentence. He's been up for parole several times, but has been denied every time. His most recent chance for freedom came in 2015. He's still locked away. Elmer Wayne Henley is currently serving six consecutive terms of 99 years for a grand total of 594 years in prison for his role in the Houston mass murders. With no chance of parole, he'll die in prison. There's no question my entire view of the world around me has changed. When I started this journey, I wanted to know why serial killers did what they did. What motivated them? What made them tick? And while I did find some answers to those questions, I also found darkness. A lot of darkness to go along with it. I know there are good people around us, but we should also never forget there are bad people around us too. Very bad people who are capable of doing things you and I could never imagine. Everything I've gone through in my personal life, in addition to delving into the lives of these serial killers, the sadness and death that I've read about every single day, has led me to the biggest question of all. Is this healthy? We all consume violence in one way or another on a daily basis. It's on our televisions, it's on the radio and in our podcasts. It's what drives storylines and plots. We turn to true crime as a means of enjoyment. I'm guilty of this myself. But what are the consequences? The long-lasting implications on all of us as individuals, as a society. I don't know if I'll ever be able to forget what I've seen in my 30 or so years of true crime infatuation, but I'm hoping some of those vivid images will begin to fade into the distance as I grow older. I haven't been able to entirely stabilize or separate my dreams from reality. I'm still working on it. For now, though, I've reached the end of my fascination with true crime. It's time to take a break. And hopefully with that break, the nightmares that have kept me up all night will transition back into normal dreams once again.
Well, today is one of those unusual days when I actually got some sleep last night. About 6 hours of sleep and I feel pretty good. It's almost like a fog is lifted from my head. Like I can think clearly. I'm kind of ready for the day, which is really pretty unusual these past few years. But I don't know. It feels good. It feels like today might be a good day, and I'm kind of looking forward to it. So, not all doom and gloom all the time. as far as sleep goes, but most of the time it is. But I thought, you know, hey, I'm having a good day. I'll talk about that too.
Insomniac is a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. Written and hosted by Scott Benjamin and produced by Miranda Hawkins, Alex Williams, Matt Frederick, and Josh Thane. Music composed by Makeup and Vanity Set and cover art by Trevor Eiler. Follow on Twitter and Facebook at Insomniac Pod, on Instagram at Insomniac Podcast, and at our website, insomniacpodcast.com. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.